Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong, and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. Today we are going back to a familiar topic that we have been to before, which is Friday the 13th and the land of Jason Voorhees. But we've never seen him in the light that we are about to discuss today. Today we're taking a look at the time well, he almost encountered Cheech and Chong. This was going to be sort of in line with the Universal Monsters meeting Abbott and Costello, a comedy version using the official franchise as a jumping point. And I think it's going to make for an interesting episode. Today, we are going to discuss the Friday franchise as a whole, as well as this unmade comedy. We're also going to take a peek into how this film, which was never made, kind of led into us getting a Freddy versus Jason, which, you know, that's horror history. Our special guest today is Jeff Seaman. He is a movie producer. He is a Friday the 13th fan, but I think I'm going to do you guys a favor and let him introduce himself. Jeff, how's it going?
It's going well. Thank you for that kind introduction.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Movie producer. Wow, that sounds so real. I've produced a few movies, one of which I'm actually wearing the shirt for that people should see soon. It's called Mutilator 2. The sequel to the 1984 cult classic film. That's the biggest film that I've ever produced, but I've got a handful of others. Been a filmmaker for about 7 years now. I kind of rose up the ranks a little quickly, but independent film is what I do most of my big work in. I have been known to do some more popular horror films, but never producing. I did the new Wrong Turn film. I worked on Haunt. And I loved that film. Strangers Pray at Night, the sequel to The Strangers. I worked that one. But that was only one day, so don't let me overblow my ego. Okay. A handful of some really cool films. And then I, in 2020, in the midst of the pandemic, I actually directed my own film called Terror Trips. That one was a challenge because it's supposed to be a movie about some people who start a business doing tours of the locations where horror films were shot. They go and they visit these locations, one of them being, by the way, the original Friday the 13th. And then they find the one location where a movie was shot where it's not just a movie that's actually real. And we've all seen horror movies. We know how that's going to turn out. That one was a challenge because it was the pandemic. So I had to rewrite the script, and we made almost every scene outside. Gave us fresh air to breathe. Everybody was still masked up and social distancing when they weren't on camera. It was fun, but 250 some odd COVID tests later and we were still all negative. But we actually made the first SAG film shot in the Midwest after the start of the pandemic. And it was a lot of fun to do despite the risks that we took. It's on Tubi. Uh-huh. It's on Amazon Prime. It's on Google Play. And it's on YouTube for rent. It's called Terror Trips.
All right, everybody. You got to check it out.
It's actually it's a pretty fun movie. It's funny watching it now. I see the flaws that are in it, but only because I've seen it 6,000 times that I notice certain things. But it's a fun ride. I had a good time with that one.
And you know, there's another movie that you've produced on the horizon that we're really excited about. Mm-hmm. I'm going to let him talk a little bit about it further, but fans of this podcast are familiar with Mary Beth McAndrews. She's the editor-in-chief of Dread Central, where I also work as the managing editor. She's been on this podcast a number of times, and she has directed her first feature film, which is now how I've met Jeff, because Jeff, you've produced it. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
I want to try and make sure that I don't go into territory where I'm saying things that I shouldn't be saying, like the specific parts of the movie. It's a rape revenge movie is what it is. And one of the things before I wanted to produce it was I'm uncomfortable with the I Spit on Your Grave series and like that. Like I liked the new version of Last House on the Left because when it comes to rape and sexual assault, they kind of went up to the line but didn't go too far over it. Whereas I Spit on Your Grave, they just went right over the line and it was a painfully long scene with the sexual assault. And the fact that Bystanders avoids any unnecessary visuals. And that was what I really liked about the script. And that was when I signed on to join it because I really didn't want to be a part of a grossly exploitative movie. And having Mary Beth on that film also convinced me that it was the right move to make. But the film itself, it's a really well-written script.
So how did you become involved with Bystanders?
The executive producer, Cole Payne, he and I were working on another film at the time called The A-Frame. You'll see that one probably in about another 9 months. And he asks me if I want to get involved with this rape revenge film called Bystanders. And two women are involved with it, one writing, one directing. And there was this Zoom call. So I jumped on and I fell so hard for Mary Beth. She's such a wonderful person. She was just great to talk to on this Zoom call. She had everything together, ready to go. So they sent me the script. I loved it. The combination of this well-written script and Mary Beth McAndrews directing it, I was sold right from the start. She was fun to work with. We get out there onto this location. It's a perfect location. We shot in a cabin and the woods surrounding it. We never left the property except for when we just needed to get away. But every scene in the movie was shot within 100 yards of the center point of this property. It was just nice spending 3 weeks down there shooting this film. She's a passionate filmmaker, even though it was her directorial debut. She knows her way around a film set. She's clearly done so many films as a producer and behind the scenes work. It was just so much fun to do that I had a great time with it. Like 20 people showing up in the woods every day to come out and make this movie. It was a blast. I can't wait for you to see it. I've seen some of the footage. It's looking really good. I'm looking forward to seeing the final cut. It should be real
soon. Me too. Yeah. And if anyone at home sort of wants to learn a little bit more about Bystanders, you can take a look at the official announcement over on Dread Central. You just got to Google Dread Central and Bystanders, and it'll pop right up. And before we get into the rest of this episode, what are you working on now, Jeff? Like, what's on the horizon for you?
I'm working on drinking this glass of water here, and that's about it.
Nice. Well,
actually, Mutilator 2, we're working on distribution for that right now. I'm going to actually, tomorrow morning, I'm going to be acting in a movie. I don't know how to act, but I'm going to try. Just a low-budget horror film produced by Hannah Fearman and starring Chaney Morrow. Going to have some fun with that. And then there's a couple of other projects that I'm looking at for the near future.
I don't want to pass over Mutilator 2 too quickly, because Mutilator 1 is just such a classic that all of our listeners are undoubtedly familiar with, from that amazing poster to the original song, Fall Break. Like, you just can't get enough of that. I'm so excited someone's bringing that franchise back to life.
And it's the same writer-director, by the way. But Buddy Cooper only made one movie, and it was The Mutilator. And he had this script written for years. We tried to make it in 2019, and Buddy fell ill. And when he was doing better again, COVID hit. So we just kept pushing it and pushing it. And finally, we got to it in 2022. Shot it at the same location as the original film.
Whoa.
There are seven people from the original Mutilator film that are in Mutilator 2. It was just so much fun. We spent 5 weeks shooting this thing on the beach, which was amazing and wonderful for everybody except the sound guy. You've ever tried to sound mix waves in the background and get them to blend? Yeah, no, that's not easy. but we had a good time. The body count is really high on this one. Nice. It's about halfway into making this film, we all started to realize just how special it was going to be, but it was only going to be special to a certain group of people, and that's people that liked the original. Mutilator 2 is not the type of movie that is for the everyday horror fan. I don't know if people who find The Conjuring to be their number one film of all time are going to appreciate this, because it's a Mutilator film. And if you've seen the original Mutilator, it's got several things. It's got some really great kills. It's got some really bad acting at points. And it's got dad jokes everywhere. And when I say bad acting, I'm not referring to our leading characters like Ruth Martinez or Bill Hitchcock or Matt Mittler or anybody like that. I'm referring to the elderly couple in the convenience store with the 10% off for senior citizen signs. Like, that woman spiked the camera so many times in that scene. That's the bad acting, but it works with the Mutilator. And there's a lot of that in the new film. There are terrible jokes that are somehow funny. There is the occasional actor that's not acting very well. But again, it's the small parts. And there's some really great kills.
Good.
In the movie. Some, I can't give you any of the kills, but they're really good.
Well, we're going to have to make sure we watch it. My question is the whoever created the poster for the original still around? And were you able to get a hold of them?
I don't know who would is. I could ask Bud Cooper who did the poster, but that was a great poster.
Oh, it's so famous.
And I mean, I'm assuming that the poster was made after the film was made, because that's a nice, you know, you couldn't have done that. Like, you couldn't have made that poster any better to the one scene that was in the movie with everybody hanging in the closet in the garage. And that tagline was great, even though it was historically inaccurate, because there was no sword used in the movie.
Oh, yes. I forgot about the tagline. By sword, by hook, by
crow. By axe, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
But what Bud Cooper wanted to do in the original was he wanted to kill people using nautical instruments. And he did repeatedly. Ooh. And he wanted to do it again in the sequel. And he did repeatedly. There's one kill on the pier that's just... it's got Carol Herring gets killed in this scene, and I'm not telling you how, but it was really well done. It was fun to shoot. We had a good time with it, and our stunt person just crushed it with that. And our stunt person actually was also another actress in the movie too, Cody Cameron. It was just fun. If you just want to see a lot of really great kills and some blood, you're going to love this movie.
And I think you were mentioning, you know, this kind of movie is not necessarily for all horror fans, but I'm pretty sure that the Mutilator series is definitely for Development Hell fans, so I know everyone's going to be psyched to check it out. And for those who cannot see, which is all of you, the Mutilator 2 shirt that he is wearing, the 2 is the hook shaped into the number 2, which is just so cool. So we're psyched. To round up this intro section, I just want to say that the sources for today's episode include the Postmortem with Mick Garris podcast, which is also hosted right here on the Dread Central Podcast Network, as well as Wikipedia. It's fine. So now we're going to jump into Friday the 13th. And one of the reasons I brought you in today is because, well, as we mentioned before, Mary Beth McAndrews, a friend of both of ours, when I asked her, you know, who would be a great guest for a Friday the 13th episode, the first name that came to her mind was Jeff. So I'm excited to talk to you a little bit about that. What was your first sort of encounter with Friday the 13th?
That is a great story, actually. I am 11 years old at the time, and my parents take my older brother and I to the drive-in movie theater. And back when that happened, drive-in movie theaters were multiplexes. There were 3 screens, sometimes 4, but there was always multiple screens happening. And we probably went to see some comedy that my dad wanted to see and knew that it was comfortable for kids. My brother was 14, I was 11. And we're watching the movie, and I'm looking out the window, just looking out the side window. And on an adjacent screen is Friday the 13th. And I'm just not interested in the movie they went to see. And I'm watching this thing. And my mom at some point turns around to check on her kids, see maybe if we're asleep at this point. I don't know. And she realizes that I'm looking in a different direction. And when she looks to see what I'm watching is the exact moment when Annie gets her throat slashed against the tree. The first kill of the counselors outside of Barry and Claudette from the opening scene. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, she says to my dad, hey, we can't have this. Our 11-year-old son is watching this woman get murdered on screen. So they pull up closer and I didn't get to see it. But by that point, it's too late. I'm hooked. I want to see more horror films. I want to see more of this type of stuff. And, you know, my foray into horror films was sealed at that moment. So I saw it at a drive-in is the short version of that story.
Wow. And it got you into the horror genre in general. That's pretty cool. So aside from that, like, was that the first film that you ever watched in the franchise? Was the first one when you finally got a hold of the actual movie itself?
I don't recall. I think that when I actually finally saw the first film, it was not see the full film for the first time. I think by that point I had already seen another one. I don't remember if we rented the original Friday the 13th before part 2 came out, but in the year that it took from between 1 and 2 to come out, my mom had realized, we created a monster, and I saw part 2 with her in the theater. She took me to it. At least that's the memory I have. Somebody told me that it was my dad, but I don't recall. I thought it was my mom. And maybe that memory is tainted a little bit because after my dad passed away, my mom and I, that's what we would do. We would watch horror movies all the time. I mean, we watched them before, but it became more of a tradition for us after he passed away. And that was only 15 years ago. So I had a long history with horror before my father passed away. But I know I saw part 2 in the theater. And then by the time 3 came out, I was old enough to kind of go alone, like, nobody really checked an ID at the door, and I started seeing them all. I'm not sure if that was the first movie I saw in its entirety, but it was either 1 or 2.
So you were able to sort of watch these movies by at least the second and third one in the theater, which is so amazing. I'm very, very jealous.
He gave me a little bit of the dizzies, which eventually later turned into vertigo, which I still get from time to time. But that 3D, man, that triggered something in my brain, but I still sat there and watched the whole thing despite being dizzy.
3D, you know, I feel like we still haven't figured it out really necessarily.
And that was terrible 3D.
Oh yes, it was.
But it was fun.
And that third film, you know, is polarizing, I think, but at least we can all be grateful that that is where we got the iconic mask.
Exactly.
But it's certainly not my personal favorite. I gotta say, I think when it comes to the franchise, I oscillate regularly between like what are my favorite films. And we're gonna dig into part six today because it has a lot to do with the unmade film that's on our slate. But number six is very regularly cited as my favorite film. But then number two is so good and so scary. I rewatched it with a friend of mine recently who had never seen part two. And I forgot, like, the final act is frightening. It's really scary and really great. Do you have a favorite film or favorite films in the franchise?
It's got to be, and I'm going to go back and forth between them for the rest of my life. It's got to be either one or two for the main reasons. But just out of sheer camp, I know that's, you know, whatever you want to say with that word. I got to go with Jason X.
Yes.
It's so terrible and so awesome.
It's so good.
And I will die on this hill that Jason X has the biggest kill count in the history of horror movies because he crashed that ship into the space station Solaris, and we don't know how many people lived on Solaris.
A lot.
Seven, yeah.
A lot.
You know, maybe the Terminator killed more people because, you know, the whole planet died. But as far as horror movies go, it is definitely Jason X.
Oh, I love Jason X. People can hate on Jason X all they want, but it is a special movie. I don't know if you're aware, I didn't mention it yet, but everyone at home knows I'm Canadian. I live in Toronto, Canada.
Okay.
And Jason X just is such a Canadian-looking movie. It's a Canadian production, and it just reeks of Canadian filmmaking. And even David Cronenberg has a bit of a cameo in it.
He's one of the first kills.
So I love Jason X. I think it's probably one of the Friday movies I've seen the most. And I think it has probably my favorite kill in the entire franchise, which is the liquid nitrogen face crush.
Yep.
But you can't deny it. It's just too good.
I think that it's, I think it, it, that one might be the most polarizing one of the entire series. Maybe that one, and what's the, Jason Goes to Hell. People either love those two movies or they hate them. There's very little middle of the road for those two films.
They are sort of a standalone, you know, entry because they were the two New Line movies. They were the ones when they lost the title. They were, you know, the two leading up to Friday versus Jason. Personally, I will say I am not a huge fan of Jason Goes to Hell. Not enough Jason action. Yeah. Not enough hell action. It's very weird.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that about it. But I would say, if I had to give you a ranking, unfortunately, that one would probably land at the bottom.
Something's got to be at the bottom of that.
Something
one.
Has to be at the bottom. I used to be just a staunch apologist for number eight, for Jason on a Boat. And then I rewatched it recently and I said, oh, I think I understand what people are talking about.
Yeah. Like, I didn't know the Crystal Lake connected to the Atlantic Ocean.
Me neither.
Apparently it does.
I
will say this about Nine. And again, saw it in the theater opening weekend. Mm-hmm. When Jason bursts out of the basement and it's finally Jason and it's not Aaron Gray or some other person, you know, doing the killing, and it was actually Jason. I don't know if I've ever heard a cheer louder in a theater than that moment. You know, the entire theater bursts into applause and screaming. And that was a fun moment. And that kind of holds a special place in my heart because of that moment in that theater.
And speaking of Jason crossovers, when you saw that movie in the theater, did you know we were going to get that ending with Freddy's glove?
It made everybody talk about it, you know. Everybody walking out of the theater just, oh my God, it's going to be Freddy versus Jason. It's going to be Freddy versus Jason. And eventually it was. That was brilliant marketing. I mean, at that point, had they even decided on doing a Freddy versus Jason?
I believe it was definitely on the table. And then that movie was stuck in development hell for a good 10 years. But yes, I believe so.
It was a brilliant piece of marketing then. They were already promoting a movie that only existed on paper. And that's hats off to that.
I know. And then I think when we finally did get Freddy versus Jason, I don't know about you, but I was happy. I was content with what we received. So
I think that one would actually be at the bottom of my Friday the 13th movie list. But doesn't mean I don't love it, you know?
Yeah, that's fair.
You got 12 movies, if you don't count the Never Hike Alone series.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of Friday the 13th fan films that are out there, and they're never going to touch Never Hike Alone. They're never going to touch that. That's really well done stuff. And there's this huge gap between the actual Friday series and Never Hike Alone. And then there's an even bigger gap between every other fan film and Never Hike Alone. So,
Is the second one out?
I don't know yet. I think it's close.
I think I keep hearing about it. It's set in the snow,
yeah.
Which is so... We got finally have Jason in the snow. Would have been waiting for it. So.
Now, there's also another film that I could count in there. 13 Fanboy, it's called.
I don't know that one.
Deborah Voorhees, who was in Part 5. Most people know her as the girl in the woods, very well-endowed woman that has sex in the middle of the woods and then gets the
top. Oh, yeah.
Through the eyes. She wrote and directed this film called 13 Fanboy. And it's the story of a killer who stalks people who were in horror films. And as if they were the actual characters in the film and not just actors playing the characters.
Oh.
And it's really well done. And I don't know if it would fall into the Friday the 13th family, but there's so many Friday actors in it. The lineup of actors, it's a who's who of horror films. And oftentimes those type of movies fail. Mm-hmm. I don't want to name names and attack any hardworking indie filmmaker or anything like that. But sometimes those large casts fail terribly. And this one, it didn't. Dee Wallace is the lead, who was never in a Friday movie, but everybody knows and loves Dee.
Oh yeah,
and then Lar Park Lincoln was in it. I'm blanking on several names, but there's at least anywhere between 5 and 10 people who have been in Friday movies.
It's a good idea.
That are in this film, and give it a chance. It's a good watch.
I would definitely try that out. Are you a fan of the Scream movies?
I am, but as far as the if you had me rank the all of these huge franchises, Saw, Nightmare on Elm Street, Scream, Friday the 13th, Halloween. I think Scream would actually come low on the
rank. Okay.
I think Scream lost its...
luster?
After 3.
Yeah. It's arguable. But I have this pitch that nobody cares about for Scream, 7, which is related to what you just said, so I want to share it. Because that's it's the meta franchise. It's the franchise that likes to sort of, fold in on itself. So I was thinking, how do we bring back all of our favorites? And I think we should go super meta with the next one, where all of the different actors from the different Scream movies are the ones that get targeted. So we could have another opening with Drew Barrymore, who gets killed first, and we could do shit like that. And I think it's one of the only franchises where it wouldn't be too much of a groan. I think it would kind of work. So
you need to watch 13 Fanboy.
I do.
Yes, you do. What you just described there, that's what they're doing.
Sick. They should make the new Scream movie. People, listen. Before we get into the details of Cheech and Chong, let's talk just a little bit more about the Friday franchise and what we would like to see happen with it. First of all, are you familiar with the upcoming Crystal Lake television series?
I am, but only to the point of what I read in, Dread or Fangoria or Bloody Disgusting. I don't know enough about it, but I also know that if Adrian King's involved, I want to see it.
She is. I think she's producing it big time with Brian Fuller.
She's a treat in every possible way. I love that woman as an actress and as a person. I actually buy wine from her winery.
How do you know her? How have you met her?
we're gonna sidetrack here.
Let's do it.
Okay. I love Friday the 13th so much that I have now for four separate consecutive years, I visit Camp Nobi Bosco, which is the original Camp Crystal Lake. They do tours. If anybody out there who is listening wants to go to crystallaketours.com. And what you can do there is sign up for a tour. You can get like a 3-hour tour for like $90. You can do an overnight for $1,000. It, you know, there's things for all different budgets. Mm-hmm. And I've done it 4 times now. And the 1 year I went, it was $400 a person, but it was a 13-hour tour. There were celebrities from several movies, mostly from the original. I think they had a dozen celebrities there. And these people would do the tour with you. They would be at the cabins. And these cabins look exactly the same as the original. Anyway, it's a long story short. At the end of the night, they showed the movie on the beach of the lake. And it was a blast. Harry Manfredini was out there telling jokes. I can't even remember all of the actors there, but there was Adrienne King. And she was so sweet and so kind. And we spent some time talking to each other, just having a great time. And she talks about her winery. And I bought 6 bottles from her, and they were delivered like a couple of weeks later. But
oh, cool.
I met her at her actual cabin from the film, is what I
was. I'm so jealous. I have to do that one day. There's no
question. It's in Jersey. It's in New Jersey. Just go to Crystal Lake Tours and check it out. You could even a 3-hour tour for like $90 a person. So worth it. It's so worth it.
100% has to happen one of these days.
Do it. It's good.
You know, is there an icon or a franchise or a character that you would want to see Jason cross over with? Is there anyone that would sort of be your go-to or sort of your fantasy crossover?
Counter to what this conversation is going to be about today, no, I don't want to see it at all. Mm-hmm. I think that the limit of what we should be doing with crossovers has happened already with the Freddy movie. I think that Friday the 13th and Jason Voorhees can stand on his own and doesn't need... I think the crossovers... I think there was a Brady Bunch Partridge Family crossover a long time ago, and producers and people in Hollywood thought, oh, this is a great thing. We're teaming up, and it keeps happening. And I think it cheapens both franchises when it happens.
You know, I think you're right. I do.
Now, that being said, I still enjoyed the Freddy and Jason film, but I didn't think it was necessary. And I think that when people talk about this Freddy versus Jason versus Ash that people keep bringing up,
yep,
why is my thought. You know, these three, yeah, well, yeah, money is the one thing. But it's like, what are you going to gain out of it? I think that Ash versus the Deadites is perfect the way it is. I think Freddy being chasing the kids and trying to survive from the attacks from Nancy and everybody is perfect. I think Ghostface, even though it's always somebody different, I think that that's great too. That dynamic between all the people that he's trying to kill and him, that's fantastic. Why mix it with other franchises that are already working? Mm-hmm. You've got so many options to do inside your own franchise. I think that's the way it should stay. But that being said, I don't speak for all of horror humanity. So give people what they want. And if they want it, great, let's do it.
I am with you on it. I do think it's kind of a cheap cash grab. And I think it's kind of this historical thing that started way, way back, as you were talking about with sitcoms, but also with Abbott and Costello back in the, I'm going to get this wrong, 50s maybe? Or you know, back in the Universal Monster days.
Yeah.
And that is where they were sort of heading tonally with the idea of Cheech and Chong and Jason sort of all getting caught up together. Would it be okay with you, Jeff, if I gave just like a little bit of a quick seminar on Cheech and Chong for those who maybe need a refresher?
I grew up in the 70s with my dad listening to those records, so I'm going to enjoy hearing this.
Well, I'm going to have to get some clarification from you, because I'm actually, you know, I know them as cultural icons, but I've never really seen any of their films, and I've never really encountered any of their comedy personally, so you're going to be very useful here. But so Cheech and Chong, they were this duo that was formed in Vancouver, Canada, represent back in the 70s and I think 80s. Cheech Marin or Marin is now 77 years old, and Tommy Chong, who's Canadian, is now 85 years old. And actually, my first encounter really with him was when he had a stint on That 70s Show back in the 90s. So that's kind of when my mom was like, yeah, you know, this is who that is, and this is a cameo. So I kind of figured that out. They found success by recording comedy albums, I believe, and having stand-up routines in the 70s and the 80s, which led to feature films, at least the first of which was really popular. And the whole sort of thesis or consensus of what they were doing is that they were these hippies in this free love era. You know, they were promoting, healthy recreational drug use, counterculture, and definitely a love of all things cannabis, which I think was probably fairly controversial back then, more so than it would be right now. So I think they got their first movie in 1978, which was called Up in Smoke, which is now, I believe, considered to be a camp classic, and was pretty successful at the box office. I think it had a pretty low budget and made over like $44 million, which was enough to get them a couple of sequels, like Cheech and Chong's next movie, which is a great title, in 1980. And I think there was one called Nice Dreams in 1981. And then there were movies in the series that maybe didn't do quite as well. Things Are Tough All Over and Smokin'. And I think that's when maybe this... when things started to lose steam for them as sort of like a mainstream duo. And even still, I believe Tommy Chong actually directed, I think, 4 of these movies, and all of them starring with Cheech. And they also had some other big moments in popular culture. They both appeared in a Martin Scorsese film, After Hours, which is a movie I love. I
just, underrated classic.
It's so good. A friend of mine, Perry Jackson, who's actually been on this podcast, introduced it to me not long ago. And it's just so, like, the vibes are just so great and so unique and so magical in it. And I think I learned that it was almost a Tim Burton film, which kind of makes sense to me. Like, there's something about it that does kind of give me Tim Burton. Jeff, you know, you were saying your parents sort of introduced you to them. What was your sort of intro to Cheech and Chong as these sort of culture icons?
Well, the records, it was real easy for mom and dad to censor things that I wasn't old enough to hear. But there's a track on one of their early albums called Sister Mary Elephant. And it's clearly at a Catholic school, and the students, they're either stoned or belligerent. They really don't want anything to do with school. And the sister's asking them all to read their essay, What I Did on My Summer Vacation. And the class would get loud, and she would eventually scream to shut up. And the class would shut up for a little while. And it just kept this repeating building of the noise, then she'd scream at them to shut up, and the students would read their essay, and it was all just stupid, in a wonderful way, stupid, I should say, just stupid comedy, and it was very a skit version of like Steve Martin's albums. It was really good, and it had this, some of the tracks had this lean of Cheech and Chong are both of Latino origins, and they lean into that heavily. The accent is thick, and Cheech Marin and Tommy Chong don't really have these thick accents. Tommy doesn't have one at all, but he would lean into it really hard, and Cheech does, and he would lean even harder into it. So it was like bringing this side that you didn't see much of on television or hear much from the Latino community, and it kind of made it okay to laugh at this as well. And these are the days when like Red Fox was dropping N-bombs constantly, and Richard Pryor was huge, and this racist comedy was the thing. But it was being done by the races that they belong to. So these guys leaning into this probably wouldn't fly very well today, what they're doing. But funny, the pot smoking would today. It like did a complete flip. But it was like, so mom and dad would protect me and my brother from anything that would be a little too over the top or the sexual references. And they tried to keep the drug humor to a minimum to us. But we got enough of a feel for who Cheech and Chong were that when that first movie came out, we wanted to see it. And mom and dad had to go see it first to make sure it was okay. And it wasn't. So I didn't see that one until I was 16. And they were just funny to laugh at because they were genuinely funny guys. And what I liked the most about them is that they didn't just settle for that. You know, they went after movies. And like people will know Cheech from Dusk Till Dawn. The Quentin Tarantino, George Clooney movie. Like Cheech plays three characters in the movie. And, you know, he went after it a little bit more. He didn't just settle for playing the same character for the rest of his life. And neither did Tommy Chong. They're both still heavy into the weed. But, and by the way, Tommy Chong's 85. I need to smoke more weed. Jeez. Yeah. My God. If he can live that long and has been doing nothing but weed smoking his whole life. But they were funny. They were classic characters, and anybody over a certain age knows who they are from the instant you mention their name.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if the new generation is familiar, because while mine, you know, they weren't everywhere, we were definitely like, we knew the names, and the names were sort of synonymous with pot, for sure, which even in the 90s was controversial.
I think a lot of people of the younger generation will mostly know from the ads that constantly pop up on Twitter promoting their CBD gummies. You can't get away from those ads on Twitter.
Oh, good for them. Get the bag.
Hey, yeah, you know, they're still making money, still doing this part of the same thing that they always did.
Did you know Tony Todd is selling, I'm pretty sure, maybe I should say reportedly selling weed now?
I'd buy some from him.
I would too. I think it's called Killer Kush, which I think is really cool. Me too. Although I would rather it be like, I don't know, something to do with Candyman, but I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
If to do it.
If he doesn't make that stuff, if he doesn't have the company make that stuff into chocolates called the Candyman, there's something wrong.
Or like THC infused honey.
Yes. You know? Yeah, oh my God, that's even better.
I love it. Just like honey flavored. Listen, I would support it. I would invest, to be honest. So
yeah, I would. Yeah, Tony Todd, do it, man. Please do it.
Yes, Tony Todd. Reportedly, because I am not able to back that up right now. Yeah. So I personally, you know, as I said, I never really encountered their comedy, but did it feel like groundbreaking at the time because of the way that they handled drug culture, or did it just feel kind of like a butt of a joke?
I think both, because it felt groundbreaking to me because it was the first time that I had ever heard anybody make jokes about weed. I was pretty young too. Mm-hmm. So I hadn't experienced much of the world. But I do know that my mom and dad found it to be really funny and they were big fans. Mom and dad probably, well, I know dad never ever smoked. Well, I hope not. I assume not. If they did, they hid it from me really well. I'm pretty sure mom and dad never ever partook in the weed, or if that's even a word. But I knew that they found it funny, and I'm pretty sure I guess the word that I might be looking for is this uniqueness that, you know, there was open comedy about weed. I think that they liked that. So maybe groundbreaking is the term for it. It was novel to them.
Mm. Yes.
Whereas nowadays, if someone came out doing that, it would just be another person joking about weed. I think they might have been the first to really do it successfully.
Well, this was just a long, winding road to get to how does Jason Voorhees enter the picture here? And I'll be honest with everybody at home, this is one of our episodes that is based on, you know, a pretty loose and light string of a resource, but it's enough to get us talking, and I think that's sort of what matters for me. So how do we know that Jason and Cheech and Chong were potentially going to team up? Well, I think as I mentioned earlier in this podcast, on Dread Central's own Postmortem, hosted by the iconic McGarris, Writer-director of Part 6, Tom McLaughlin, the director, writer of Jason Lives, Friday the 13th, Part 6, said that he actually was pitching two crossover ideas to producer Frank Mancuso Jr. after the success of his film, one of which was Freddy vs. Jason, and the other, well, was Freddy vs. Cheech and Chong. And he was on Mick Garris's podcast, and if it's okay with you, Jeff, maybe I can quote a little bit what he had to say about these two potential films. So here's what Frank Mancuso Jr. sort of started off by saying. He said, Paramount wanted another film after we did Jason Lives. And I said, well, what are you thinking? I don't know what it could be now. And he said, well, what do you think about Freddy and Jason? And he goes, well, but Freddy's at New Line and the guys at Paramount have Jason. And it was like, well, we're going to try to see if we can work something out. So I started thinking about going at it, and well, it doesn't make sense. I mean, he lives in one realm, and well, I take this stuff very seriously. What realm a monster is supposed to stay in? And he came back and goes, eh, forget it. It's not going to work anyway. So it seems like, now I'm talking back in Josh's voice, that Frank, no, I'm sorry, not Frank Mancuso, that Tom McLaughlin had a similar viewpoint of you, Jeff, where it's like he understood that logically, and it just didn't make sense to pit Freddy and Jason. Like, it does make sense from a business standpoint, but from like the heart of where these films are coming from, like, yeah, they exist in different realms, and it's interesting that Tom sort of felt that way from the beginning. Is that kind of, do you feel the same way from these words as I do?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they did have a nice out where they could say Freddy can be killed if he gets brought into the real world, which allowed them to be in the same world again. And that was a nice way to set up the fight between the two. I just didn't really see much more than that. And that was good writing to be able to bring Jason and Freddy together. Other than that, no, I didn't understand why. Yeah, I'm in the same boat with him there. But I mean, I'm glad they made it.
I am too.
Yeah.
But, and it's so interesting that this, you know, Freddy vs. Jason goes as far back as 1986 after the release of Friday 6. So it's really going far, far back. And that one of the first creatives on board, or at least in the room, was Tom McLaughlin, who is just so talented and kind of, I don't know, could be cited as inventing the meta slasher in a way with Friday 6. You know, it's pre-Scream, yeah, and I think he was even approached with Scream, and he said, well, I've done this already, why would I do this again? I think he regretted that decision.
Probably.
So after this conversation about Freddy versus Jason, he was stewing, and he was thinking, well, like, who else would make sense? And I think he went to go see, like, what Paramount properties, you know, could potentially add up for Jason. And he said on the podcast, you know what? You guys own Cheech and Chong. You know, what if we do Cheech and Chong meets Jason? They're like camp counselors or something. It's like, hey, man, I saw Jason out there. No, man, that's a myth. He said, you know what? No. And so clearly Frank Mancuso Jr. didn't let this idea get too far. But it's enough to be a bit of a footnote in horror history, and was enough for us to sort of come together today about it. So, Jeff, do you think this could have worked? Do you think that there's a world where, like, we could have established this Abbott and Costello silliness in this franchise?
I think so, but where I think it might have worked best would be a short film. Really, how much can you do? Now, obviously, you can do a lot, because way worse movies have been made that made money. I'm looking at you, James Corden, and everything you've ever done. I would say it would probably do really well as a short film, maybe up to 20 minutes or so. But I don't know how much you could actually get out of that before it just got tired. That being said, a movie like Sleepaway Camp, which had a heavily comedic vibe to it at points, and was still a quality slasher film with a great twist to it, you can still pull off the comedy, but at some point you got to pick a lane. Are you going to go comedy? Are you going to go horror? You can do both, but when you've got something that is so very one-sided horror and one that is so very one-sided comedy, it's going to be tough to mix the two. Mm-hmm. Like Tucker and Dale versus Evil, that pulled off well with horror comedy, mainly because there was no history for this. Everything that you saw in that movie was within its own little 90-minute world, or however mm-hmm. long the movie was. Cheech and Chong and Jason Voorhees have these long histories. And if you draw either one of them away from what they're known for, it's not going to work after a while. Now, watch, tomorrow there's going to be a release that they've finished production on this film, and it's fantastic, and it's got 110% on Rotten Tomatoes. But in my myopic view at this time, I don't know how it would work longer than 5 to 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think it would be a great sort of special feature on something. I agree with you. But a full-length version, I don't know. As I said earlier, you know, number 6 is one of my favorite entries of the entire franchise, and clearly number 6 is where we get a little bit more purposefully campy. We get a little more purposefully self-aware, and things take a different turn. I'm wondering, how do you feel about, you know, when Jason gets, like, when Jason gets a little more playful and self-aware? Do you prefer it when it's full-on horror?
I do like it when he, when there are those moments. But again, they're brief moments. They don't lean into it too hard. When he punches Julius's head off on top of that building in part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, that's funny. Mm-hmm. That's a good comedy moment. I'm trying to think of some other moments where he has those brief seconds of awareness, or where he comes out of character for a second. I'm trying to think of any right off the top of my head. I'm not coming up with any. But my point being, they're all real short. They're real quick moments. And then he goes right back to just killing people in the most horrific ways possible, which is why I start to talk about, I don't know if Cheech and Chong would work.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. I think having it exist in the realm of meta humor is fine, sort of like Scream. But taking it fully into the world of comedy, I think, would have been maybe not the most respectful move to such an iconic horror genre. You're a horror movie producer, so you could be a really great insight for this. I have heard from different producers and through the grapevine that horror comedies are actually like really tough to sell. Is that something that you think there could be truth behind?
I think any movie is really tough to sell. But horror comedy, it's so rarely done. And when it's done right, it's even more rare. Evil Dead 2 is a good example. That was definitely more horror than it was comedy, but it still tags the horror comedy label. How are you gonna take a Raimi film and make it again? It's really tough to pull off that type of film, let alone to sell it. Mm-hmm. Tucker and Dale is a good example. There's several good horror comedies. I think Shaun of the Dead leaned more towards comedy than it did horror, but it was really good. But they're rare. It's not easy to even make one, let alone sell it. There's an audience for it. It's just, it's one of those difficult combinations to pull off. As far as like crossovers go, and since that's one of the topics that we're doing here, I think that the best crossover horror movie that I've ever seen didn't advertise itself as a horror crossover movie, and it was Friday the 13th, Part 7. That's Carrie White. Oh. That is Carrie White. She is in that movie. It's just not named Carrie White. It's Laura Parkman playing this character that has the ability to move things and change the world with her mind. That's Carrie White. And they did a great job having Carrie versus Jason. And they didn't advertise it as such. They just went out and freaking did it, and it worked. Not many people appreciate that movie for what it is, but it's a really good film. And I think that that might be a good way to do it. Although they kind of did do Cheech and Chong in Part 3, the hippies in the back of the van, wasn't both male. It was a male-female combination. But that guy was Tommy Chong, you know, of the day. What year was that movie? 1982, 83? Mm-hmm. That was at the height of Tommy Chong and Cheech Marin's popularity. They were clearly doing him in that movie. And that might be another place where they thought this might work as a crossover idea, because they've already seen the stoners involved.
And we have also seen Jay and Silent Bob in Scream 3. So
yeah,
it does kind of happen.
A Scream might actually, in some instances, might be considered horror comedy too. I don't think so, but there are moments where they pull off comedy. But again, it's Wes Craven. You know, he's going to be able to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm never going to go for horror comedy because I'm just not that seasoned of a writer or a director. Oh, yeah.
Sam Raimi, there's only one, right? Wes Craven, there's only one. There are the exceptions to the rules. They can do what they want.
And Edgar Wright, you know, I mean,
there's
that guy can do anything he wants.
Yes.
These are always brilliant.
Yes.
There's so few of those people walking the earth, and one of them isn't anymore, Wes Craven. We lost him 6-7 years ago. It's not an easy genre to pull off, let alone to sell. It's you just got to take it as the gem in the field that it is.
So to get into the land of conclusions, to wrap everything up, my first question for you is, do you think this movie could ever happen? Do you think there's any chance for Cheech and Chong and Jason to actually meet each other?
As long as they're, yes, I definitely think that it could happen. Whether or not it will is a different discussion, but there's a movie about a sloth that's
Slaughterhouse.
That it's, oh my God, if that movie can get made and released and do well, which I think it will, anything can be made. I absolutely love Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
They lean heavily into the comedy in this comedy horror. And if movies like that are just so stupid that they're awesome, craptastic is the word that we use.
Yeah.
They're so terrible that you love them. And more power to the makers of these types of movies. But the problem that we will have with Cheech and Chong versus Jason Voorhees is those things are tied to studios, man. These types of movies, Slaughterhouse, is that what it's called, Slaughterhouse? And Thanksgiving and stuff like that. These are very clearly independent filmmakers with very little money to work with, and sometimes those are the most creative people in the world. I just don't know if a studio can lean into something like that.
I hear you.
You can see that. I could see that movie happening if it was done as a fan film or something that would then get sued out of existence. I could see it happening. I just don't know if it will in our lifetimes.
And on that note, Jeff, this has been an awesome conversation. Thank you so much for joining me. My last question for you is, where can you be found online if you wish to be found?
I still belong to X, Twitter. No matter what that idiot calls it, it's Twitter. Jeff from Ohio is my tag there. You can find me on TikTok under Terror Trips. Just find me on Facebook. I'll talk to you. I'm open with fans or people who just want to talk horror films for me. But more importantly, you can find me on Twitter, or I mean on Tubi. Watch my movie Terror Trips. There.
Yes.
That's my story.
Watch Terror Trips. And then also make sure you watch Mutilator 2 and Bystanders when they are available.
Exactly. Yes.
Wonderful.
But, come find me on social media. I'd love to talk.
Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.